namely the relationship of humanity to the world which God created, and what our present state of that relationship is, and what we can learn biblically and theologically to inform our future. I've been working on these questions both in biblical study and in writing. I finished a book manuscript that is in this general area that'll be out in about a half a year or so, and continue to feel that the whole issue is very central to how we all understand our faith. And I hope that that will become evident as we go along in the course of our evening. The way I want to start is to ask any of you, to simply say what comes to your mind when I say the word nature. What comes to your mind? What do you think of when I say nature?
God's creation.
All right, let's slow down just a little bit, all right? Just repeat some of those things.
God.
Resources.
Beauty.
Out of doors.
Trees
and mountains.
Life.
Animals.
Rain.
Wilderness.
Interaction.
How about a two-word answer? Covering all of this.
Holden Village. All right.
Plants.
Man.
Excuse me?
Man.
That's interesting.
Life.
Responses are kind of running along two ways. Several of you were said things like plants, animals, wilderness, and so forth. A few others, one person said God. I think the only one. Others, someone said man, let's just say humanity. Okay, I'm gonna erase this in a minute, so don't worry. Someone said life. Someone said interaction. Right? See any, you see how those might fall into kind of two categories? There is a common way in our culture, when we say nature, what we think of is, the out of doors. Someone in fact said the outdoors. We sort of think of Holden Village. All right?
That's my idea.
Yeah. we think of a place that's kind of out, that we could sort of escape to or go to for a retreat, an interlude, a place where we might visit. That's certainly the idea in wilderness. We think of things that are out there and that are apart from us. Trees, plants, animals, the mountains. Another way of thinking about what we call nature is captured a little bit by some of these comments here. Interaction, life. I mean, suddenly these are becoming much broader all of a sudden, right? Humanity, and one person even said God. Tell the person who said God, tell me why you said God. Was that you? Is that sort of just what came into your mind, or what?
First word that came into
first
my
word,
mind.
Okay, all right.
Because this is how we know God, is how he acts through everything that he's created and everything right. that he's done and everything that he's made.
Right.
That's all nature.
All right. All right. I want to come back to that, I think. Yep.
All those things in the world that are natural phenomena.
Such as?
You think of man as a natural phenomenon, something
uh-huh.
that has grown into the earth,
uh-huh.
the earth.
Uh-huh.
It's an evolutionary sort of thing, but which are natural in the sense of nature.
Uh-huh. The word, of course, the word that you're talking about, natural,
yes.
is, of course, comes from the word nature.
Right.
Naturalism, study of the natural order, and then a whole slew of natural theology, all kinds of categories. I want to read a quote from some of you are from the Seattle area. I don't know how well you know your history. I was interested to learn that Seattle is named, well, anyone who's even visited Seattle and been down to the waterfront and read a little bit, you know, Seattle's named after Chief Seth, S-E-A-L-T-H. And the white settlers got his name wrong and became Seattle. He was a prominent Indian chief in the region, and when the first white settlers came, and they were, as was normally the case, particularly in this part of the country, they were followed fairly quickly by missionaries, and he converted to Christianity. And yet, that didn't ease the tensions that he had with the white settlers. And finally, it came down to a point in 1854, as settlement in the region had grown, where the white settlers wanted to buy the land on which Chief Self's tribe was living, and move the chief and his tribe to a reservation, which was a common and very tragic story during that time, happening throughout different portions of the Great Plains in the West and the Pacific Northwest. Chief Self gave a very moving address on this occasion, which a missionary there who knew his native tongue recorded, and we have a fairly good rendition of it. In part of that address, Chief Self said, and he had in mind the kind of pattern he had seen, the virtual disappearance of the buffalo, the kind of destruction of the land that had happened with white settlement. And he said to the whites who had proposed this, and he really didn't have much choice about the matter, because by this time the cavalry had overpowered his forces, and so it wasn't as if he had really a choice. But he said, "How can you buy or sell the sky or the warmth of the land? This idea is strange to us. If we do not own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, then how can you buy them? This we know. The earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. This we know. All things are connected." Someone said interaction. "All things are connected, like the blood which unites one family." He went on to talk about the God of the white men who had also become his God, and said, "You may think now that you own him as you wish to own our land, but you cannot. He is the God of humanity, and his compassion is equal for the red man and the white. This earth is precious to him, and to harm the earth is to heap contempt on its creator. Continue to contaminate your own bed, and you will one night suffocate in your own waste. So, if we sell you our land, love it as we've loved it, care for it as we've cared for it, hold in your mind the memory of the land as it is when you take it, and with all your strength, with all your mind, and with all your heart, preserve it for your children and love it as God loves us all." The kind of picture of nature that Chief Self was speaking out of is quite different from the picture of nature, which we commonly bring to the associations with that word. You remember how Larry said this morning, 90% of what we see is behind our eye. We come with a set of perceptions, presuppositions, assumptions. And the assumptions, the presuppositions which this chief brought to the subject of nature was quite different than that which the white settlers had brought. Even though both were Christian, both were claiming allegiance to the same God. And the actions of the chief and his people, contrasted to the actions of white settlers, were also very different. Simply bring this out in order to say that the ways in which we think about nature aren't eternal and haven't been that way the whole time in a given culture, aren't that same way around the world. Any of you who have had overseas experience quickly come to know this. Rather, the ways in which we think about nature are conditioned, are influenced by the culture in which we have grown up, by the attitudes that we've inherited, by the ways in which we've been taught. And that's a natural sort of occurrence. But it's important to keep it in mind, and particularly as we go on, I think we'll see why it's important to remember this. I want to try something else. I want you to give me the names of the shopping centers where you go and shop. All right? Just
Valley North.
Valley North. Just think of the shopping center. Just speak it out. Okay.
Maplewood Mall.
Just a second. Maplewood Mall. Okay.
Rosedale.
Maplewood Mall. Rosedale. Okay.
Candy Mall.
Rosedale. Candy Mall.
Northgate.
Skylark.
Northgate. I just put down North. Skylark.
Northridge Heights.
Washington Square.
Excuse me, what?
West Ridge Heights.
West Ridge Heights.
Washington Square.
Okay.
Aurora Village.
Washington Square.
Portland, Oregon.
any others?
Aurora Village. Aurora Village.
Aurora Village, okay.
Apache Plaza.
Apache Plaza? Terrific.
Tyson's Corner,
okay. All right, this is, excuse me? What?
Tacoma Mall,
well, that's kind of.
How about the building?
All right, this gives an idea. Some of these sort of, some malls are named for, geographical locations and so forth, but some of you ever thought about this or not. Valley North, Maplewood Mall, Rosedale, Skylark, West Ridge Heights, Apache Plaza. What do you see happening here?
Nature's names.
Why are we naming shopping malls according to nature's names? Because why?
They ruin nature.
Because they... It's a guilt reversal because we ruin nature. You know what the first mall in Chicago was that I remember? It's Old Orchard.
Yeah.
All right. And when I grew up in the Chicago area. And then there came to be Woodfield. We literally are naming what we've destroyed.
Oak Brook.
Yeah, in Chicago, in the Chicago area. Oak Brook. You ever been to Oak Brook? I mean, it's not an oak or a brook within miles of Oak Brook.
I don't know if it's necessarily a guilt reversal.
All right.
But I think it's a advertising gimmick because it makes a more wholesome sound.
Mm-hmm.
It's nostalgic.
Nostalgic? Advertising? Okay, so it's maybe some of those influences too. What about advertising? You said, maybe people, they don't come up with these names out of nowhere. I mean, they... They name something because they think they're going to get a response, and that's
a catchy phrase,
particularly true in the advertising world. What?
It also is the place.
Right.
I mean, it's Maplewood Mall is in Maplewood, Minnesota.
All right.
So, you know, that's.
But then, how did Maplewood, Minnesota, get its name?
Because it's all the maples.
How are the maples
beautiful
doing?
That is an area where there are a lot of maples, so it's Maplewood, where the homes have been built. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I understand. I've never been there, but I've been to Elmhurst, Illinois, and I know how the elm trees are.
The maples are still alive.
Good. You see the same thing in the names of a lot of settlements, which originally are named for something that's in that area, but when you then see what happens, you see that what it was named after is what begins to suffer the effects of being settled there.
How do you reconcile Indian names prevalent throughout our nation?
It's a whole, the use of Indian names, I think, is a whole another subject that I myself see two things going on. I mean, one is that you see that a lot more prevalent in the West than you do in the East or in the Midwest. And it's partly because we're closer to that part of our history in this part of our country than we are elsewhere. I also think that it's part of an attempt to sort of romanticize that past reality and to really not deal with what actually happened. I mean, I think that in general, a lot of these names kind of do that within the society. But that's kind of going in a different direction.
Yes, I think that's common all over the country.
All right.
Back east, we have the Mohegan, the Allegheny,
okay.
The Mohawk, and all kinds of Indian names.
Right.
The southeast does too.
Sure.
In the south, I know, is Indian.
All right. Well, then I'm probably I should probably stand corrected and say it's not only, but it's just as much in the east. All right. Now that someone said, well, maybe it's advertising is involved. What kinds of things seem to sell products these days? Especially when we think about nature, right? Why do they put these cars on icebergs and they advertise new cars, showing them in places where a car can never get, right?
Something different.
On top of a mesa they put automobiles in locations where an automobile never should or could get to.
They're trying to convince you that all the asphalt paving and all that sort of thing, and they're ripping and roaring and tearing and smashing them up and smashing up people, really isn't all that bad, that it's just part of things, and if nature's good, so is automobile.
Any other comments?
Eye-catching, I would say.
Eye-catching?
On usual, you know, it's going to be.
Anything to do with nature is more appealing to the human eye and human thought, I think.
Anything to do with nature, now again, remember that word we're using, is appealing to the human eye, you said.
And the hearing.
And by nature, what do you think? Are you kind of thinking on the category we had on this side of the board originally, the mountains, the trees, the plant, the scenery, sort of, right?
Yeah,
the outdoors, the wilderness. There's something about nature in our society which we really want to sentimentalize it, right? We want to treat it as an object of sentiment, sort of have nostalgic and warm memories about it.
Like Marlboro.
Marlboro country. All right.
The advertisements for the pickup trucks that can bounce over any place in nature.
Okay.
You want to dominate nature. You want to rule over it instead of letting nature be a part of it.
Right.
also locations the
Colt, the Wrangler, the Cougar, the Lynx, the named after
animals. All the cars that are named after animals. Okay, that's what Rudy is saying. And this gentleman said, it's not just sentiment, but dominate. A strong theme of wanting to dominate over nature. Yes, ma'am.
Isn't nature also considered pure? And we like things that are pure and not undefiled.
Pure and undefiled. That kind of goes with, doesn't that go with the with the sentiment, right? We have this view.
Freshness is freshness, like the cigarette they have.
Yeah, you can't take the country out of Salem. I don't know how the country got in there in the first place. It's hard to figure out, but or liquor. Jane B. Scotch, for instance, in the New Yorker, practically every issue there's Jane B. Scotch whispers, and it's just what it is. The scene of someplace out in the middle of nowhere with a canoe going across, you know, and that's the advertising for Scotch.
Maybe a vacation dream with a means that could bring us there, even though it's not quite practical. I mean, how would a nice small sports car get us on an iceberg or something like that? But to just bring two realities into an unreal combination.
Right, two realities into a very unreal combination in order to sell a project. A product.
Yes.
This theme of domination. Now, in reality, what is nature? What we think about nature? I mean, what is it really like? I mean, is it, where is nature pure and undefiled? Holden Village. What's up on the hill? Okay. Where is nature pure? You see, nature as pure and undefiled, whatever we mean by that, is almost an illusion, is almost something in the imagination, something that may be strong for advertising images, but something which in our lives, even when we ride a boat for 3 hours and a bus up this far in a place where you can't get to by a car and there's no phone and so forth, nature even here is hardly undefiled. In fact, the reality is that humanity's domination of nature is putting nature in a state of ruin, even while nature is consistently held up as an object of sentiment. I want to give you just a few statistics, okay? In the U.S., each day, the equivalent of 34 square miles of soil are lost through both erosion and through what we call development, namely new shopping malls, subdivisions, and so forth. The equivalent of 34 square miles of soil lost each day through those two causes. And how much is that? A report called the Cornucopia Report, who looked at all the figures from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and other studies and put this together, said that amount of soil which we lose each day to those causes is enough to provide the minimum yearly diet for 260,000 people. We're losing that much of our soil. And that's just in North America. You know, when you drive, I don't know if any of you drive from Spokane, but when I was on my way here, I kept seeing these great clouds of dust. There's a lot of soil in the air. I don't know the agriculture of the region too well, but it seemed to me that one crop had just been harvested, and they were going over many of the fields again with tills, cutting it up once again, and in that process, maybe a little bit each year, but each year it builds, and it's lost further than it's replenished. Wood. There's a lot of wood around here. And appropriately, that wood's used for a lot of practical purposes. Throughout the world, when you look at poor, less developed regions, you find that each year about 11 million hectares of tropical forest are destroyed. One large place this is happening is in the Amazon. At such a rate that people are worried about the effect that this is having on the global, on the globe's atmosphere, because of all the photosynthesis that's lost by that much forest being lost, to say nothing of all the species of life that become extinct because of that level of destruction. The Global 2000 report, which was prepared at the direction of President Carter, and which was to look at all the world's resources and to sort of say, where is it going to be by the year 2000? There is a summary of that report available in the Holden bookstore. And about forests, it says when you look at the less developed countries of the world, if we go at the rate we're going now, the accessible forests in the world's poorer countries, the forests that you can generally get through, get to, they're going to be practically gone by the year 2020, which is less than 40 years from now. And in less developed countries, the shortage of firewood is the real energy crisis. You know, that's their energy source. They're not rich enough to worry about oil for the most part. They have to worry about firewood. And attempts to engage in reforestation are often frustrated because of people's immediate need to get wood to heat their meals. And when that wood is then cut, then any of you who've worked or even just been out if you've been out in a clear cut, even if it's Douglas fir, and I worked for several years with a senator from Oregon, and I know all the reasons why it's said that it's smart to clear-cut Doug fir. Nevertheless, you go by an area that's been clear-cut, and you know what happens to the soil, all right? Well, think if that's in India, or if that's in the Philippines. And think then of not only are you depleting that forest resource, but you're also then not holding the soil itself. Water. The Ogallala Aquifer, that's another Indian name.
Can I invite one more time?
Ogallala.
Well.
Ogallala, I'm sorry, I missed it now. Ogallala. Ogallala. Aquifer. Aquifer is a water table underneath the ground. One of the largest ones in the country, which basically stretches from in the area of the Texas Panhandle up through South Dakota, through the central portion of the Great Plains. People are saying that it may have no more than 40 years of useful life. Any of you drive through that area, you see all the irrigation. The whole system of agriculture there is built upon irrigation. Yet in some places in that aquifer, the water is being drained out at between 15 to 18 times faster than it is naturally replenished by rainfall. Which simply means the water table is going down, and you just can't keep that up. It's the exact same problem that is facing many areas of India right now, particularly the area I'm most familiar with in South India, where the Green Revolution put in all this system of irrigation, which was to make so much progress, and now people are complaining about the weak monsoons. Well, the monsoons have been weak for the past 3 years, but the real problem is that those aquifers that they've been drawing out of are simply going down further and further. And you get requests from churches that say, we have to dig our wells deeper. Well, you know, that may help for 3 years, but what about just 10 years from now? So the real picture of what we call nature, the reality of what's going on, is a pattern of a pretty severe ruin that comes from our what we would call the domination of nature. And you can, you know, this has been documented very clearly in all of our major, air, water, land, energy. I think most of us know that something is out of kilter here. We sense it a little bit here. You go to poorer countries, and there the effects are much more intense, much more immediate. There's something out of harmony. Another dimension of this. When you think about what we call nature, humanity now has the capacity, technologically, to actually destroy all, virtually all, of what we call nature. We just had this in the past, roughly 20 years, 15 years, but suddenly it's awesome to think we have the technological ability not just to make war against other people, but to actually do a pretty thorough job in destroying creation. And then when you read the advances going on in genetic engineering today, you suddenly begin to discover that we are obtaining the technological capacity to create what eventually you're going to have to call new species of life. That our domination of this world of nature is now so great that we actually have the power of life and death over the creation. A couple of years ago, the Supreme Court said that a new form of bacteria, which was a new life form, could be patented. It's a major decision, 1981. The new organism, this happened to be an organism developed by a company called Genutech that was supposed to be able to eat up oil spills. Right? But it's a life form which was created, and there was this big issue over, well, okay, you know, we've created this, we'd like to get a patent on it now, you know. And I mean, this isn't an engine. It's not a, you know, it's not a new rotary lawnmower or something. I mean, it's a new form of life. One of the companies that's very deeply involved in this is General Electric. Who can tell me what General Electric's current advertising slogan is?
Used to be, progress is our most important product.
It's not anymore. We bring good things to life. General Electric, we bring good things to life. And don't know how good they are, but they are bringing, I mean, that's what they're doing. And the ethical and moral implications of these issues are barely being considered. People, I think, are as euphoric about the possibilities of genetic engineering today as they were about the possibilities of nuclear physics in 1946. What's happened, and what I want to underscore here, is our power over what we call creation. And if these things are true, then it seems to me that the theology, I mean, how we understand the relationship between humanity and nature is absolutely critical. I mean, if the church, if we as Christians are concerned about this, we have better start thinking and start reading and start studying and start trying to discover what does our faith have to say about how we are to relate to this, to what we call nature. Because I tell you, on the one hand, it seems as if we're having destructive effects on it all over, which seems to be putting things in serious disorder, with study after study saying We just can't go on this way. In 20 years, in 40 years, in 60 years, there's just not going to be enough to go around. And at the same time, we have what I think you could only call godlike powers over creation. Powers technologically, which humanity in all its previous history has never had before. Now, let's move on quickly. Immediately when we try to come up and say, well, here are some of the answers. Here is what the church, stewardship, or maybe, we have to, you know, we start struggling with some positive answers, and then you listen to people who say, wait, Christian faith, you don't have any answer. You are part of the problem. The reason why our relationship with nature is so messed up is because of you. You talk to some environmentalists who are, philosophical, and that's exactly what they're going to say. Let me give you even Arnold Toynbee, who sometimes pastors like to quote him, but I don't think they've ever quoted this. The recklessly extravagant consumption of nature's irreplaceable treasures and the pollution of those of them that humanity has not already devoured can be traced back in the last analysis to a religious cause, and this cause is the rise of monotheism. Man's greedy impulse to exploit nature used to be held in check by his pious worship of nature. This primitive inhibition has been removed by the rise and spread of monotheism. And he goes on then to talk about Genesis 1:28. We studied that this morning with Larry. Subdue the earth. And Toynbee says, this injunction to subdue, which modern man has taken as his directive, is surely immoral, impractical, and disastrous.
Okay. The Bible just said subdue, it didn't say to conquer.
Okay. I mean, maybe we need to look again at that passage. I think surely we do. But I'm saying this is what others outside of the church are saying. Now, do you think that they have a point? Do you think that are there people today in the church that sort of say things like that, are Christians? Officials? Or not saying anything? How about any people come to mind and who maybe have some political power today, too?
James Watt?
Okay. He was before a House Interior Committee, and he was asked about a particular policy about future resource conservation. He said, I'm not sure how many future generations we have until the Lord returns. The sort of thing that makes a kind of secular environmentalist say, see, I told you so. How are these Christians going to help us?
May I make an observation?
Yes, sir.
During the late 40s, just after World War II and into the 50s, I was, as an orchardist, involved in what they know as the soil conservation district.
Sure.
And what you're saying now, we were pleading mm-hmm. for conservation in those days mm-hmm. that of the acreage being taken out just for farmsteads, mm-hmm. school district buildings, let alone highways, mm-hmm. that the highways, for the convenience of man, and man wouldn't back it up and say no to go straight through the best farming area you've got mm-hmm. because it was easy to handle mm-hmm. and made per mile road building cheaper,
yep. mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. that we needed to conserve our water, even in the great state of Washington, who has mm-hmm. water mm-hmm. at that time running out its ears.
Right.
Now I'm hearing that what we had predicted could be said as population increased yeah. and demands were made that we didn't even know about, mm-hmm. that we would begin to say ourselves, hey, wait a minute here, we're going to run out of water if we're not careful. And it's the whole thing, the way I've seen it develop, is just simply man's greed. In other words, I am going to farm my soil, my farm, the way I want to, and I don't give a tinker's damn what happens to the kids that come along. That's what we're saying, and that's a hard line, and you get criticized for saying it, you see? And so what was said in those days that what we predicted would happen, only thing was we put it off a little longer than it was supposed to be thought, see? Men were saying that all over the United States in farming, pleading with people to learn the practices that would stop the erosion of their farms. Because nature takes 1,000 years to build 1 inch of soil. And we only have, in burying places, from 6 to 12, 18 inches of real genuine topsoil. There are places where it's out in the big bend of, in the basin of the Columbia Basin, as deep as 20 feet. But you have other soils that are just barely inches.
And when you lose it.
And when you lose it, it takes 1,000 years to replace it. 1 inch of it only.
And how
and
much?
A hard rainstorm can destroy in 1 hour on an unprotected slope an inch of soil.
And how much do you think of the topsoil in North America has been lost since we began till agriculture?
I don't think you can measure it hardly.
Big.
Something like a farm every hour goes down the Mississippi River. And it's in Missouri in this tributary.
People generally say, I mean, the other scientists who are true try to put a number on this, say at least a third of the topsoil built up the way he says has been lost since
I think that would be right.
And of course it varies widely from region to region. Some places much worse. Besides the question of James Watt and the Second Coming and Arnold Toynbee and so forth, others were sort of say, well, look it, don't you sort of have a dichotomy in Christianity between spirit and the world, or between flesh and the soul? Isn't there a sense, and again, these are more often critics, saying one reason why Christianity is part of the problem is that somehow it sort of divides things up and sort of says things that aren't material, you know, really don't matter as much. And if you then have modern science coming along, as it has during the past three centuries, and saying what reality is really only matter. You know, it's just bits of particles. Now, your theoretical physicists and people today are much brighter than that. They're no longer saying that. But I think the kind of view that sort of grew up in our culture is, you know, reality out there is just matter. It's just these bits of particles that are kind of, you know, bouncing around and forming all this stuff. Well, you know, then a lot of Christians began saying, well, if matter is only matter, it doesn't really matter. I mean, it's just going to kind of pass away anyway. So, what I'm trying to point out is that we've got a lot of heavy baggage here. I mean, the problem, not only do we have these concrete problems to face, but we in fact, at least we're being charged as being culprits in creating these problems. And we have to sort that out as well. Now, real quick, what really has happened? The kinds of attitudes about nature that we were talking about at the beginning, thinking of nature as on this side of the board as trees and rocks and outdoors and wilderness and as things that were out there, away from us. Okay, we were here. Okay. And nature are these things out here. And we and we observe them, we study them in order to control. The idea really started with Francis Bacon, who was the author of the scientific method. He said that we should make nature our slave. And before the scientific sort of attitude developed, the average person didn't have this sense of detachment and removal from nature. In the Middle Ages, one commentator, Owen Barfield, who studied this, says in the Middle Ages, humanity's relationship to nature was more like an embryo and less like an island. Do you see the difference? That the world of nature was something in which we dwelt and were intrinsically a part of, woven into it, rather than something which we set ourselves apart from in order to observe, understand, and control. Now, it's not to say that this sort of stance is never appropriate. We're not going to get into an argument about whether, you know, all the things that science has done, et cetera, et cetera. Of course. But if this is the primary way in which we understand nature, we're set up for a stance of domination, control, treating it as an object, not being sensitive to its relationship back to us, and in fact, going down the course that we presently seem to be on. Now, when only one person mentioned God when I said nature, why do you think that is?
Because he wasn't said in church.
Because he wasn't said in church, maybe. What has happened? Do you think that if we were sitting around with a bunch of people from one of the tribes of Israel, do you think we would have had the same kind of response?
No, because natural gods were anathema.
Natural gods were anathema, okay. Do you know what?
They were agrarian people.
They were agrarian people. Well, they became, after the wilderness, yes, they became agrarian people. But do you know, if we were sitting around as Hebrew people thinking about this, do you know, I could not even ask that question. I could not even say, what do you think of when I say nature? Why? Because there is no word in Hebrew which can be translated as nature. Why not? What does it mean if there's not a word? No concept. The idea of nature as something separate from humanity and something separate from God literally doesn't even exist in the mind of the Old Testament. And I would also argue strongly in the mind of the New Testament as well. It's a modern way of thinking. And it's a, you know, it's a way we've grown up thinking, but it's a way that is in fact foreign to all the presuppositions of the people who wrote and who gave us the Bible, who gave us the tradition of our faith. Because to the Hebrew and in the mind of the Old Testament, there is a creation. That's why I like to use that word. In thinking about these things, I'm not even going to use the word nature anymore because I think it's so terribly misleading if we're going to talk theologically. There is a creation, and the creation depends solely and totally upon God. is sustained every day by God, includes within that humanity, and all is part of one whole. I don't know if any of you saw Elena's presentation this morning, but she gave a real quick kind of view. She contrasted our kind of hierarchy with a sort of a God, and you know, right? That's the way the Hebrew mind thought. And that's the kind of presuppositions that the Bible begins with when it talks about what it calls, again, using just rough translations, the world of creation. So you begin at a very different place. Nature in our culture has become secularized. Now, you probably haven't, you know, you hear a lot about schools becoming secular and society going secular. Well, nature went secular a long time ago. What does secular mean?
Business as usual.
Well, no. Yeah, one level.
Non-Christian?
Ungodly. Non-Christian, ungodly. Secular means something defines itself as though God does not exist. Okay, it defines itself on its own terms. So if a schooler has become secular, then it's defined itself, I mean, that's the true meaning of the word. And we use that word a lot of other ways. But the true meaning of the word is that it something defines itself as though God is not. All right, our view of nature is secularized. We think of nature, not all the time. Some of us who are Christians, we all, you know, like, for instance, like yourself. Nature is what God made. All right, but the dominant view in society that we've been talking about is a view that totally detaches nature from God. And that, interestingly enough, also tends to detach nature from humanity. And that's the most ludicrous of all, because no one in this room could live for more than a minute or two without air, or for more than a day or two without water, or for more than a week or two without land from which to produce food. I mean, our life is dependent moment by moment on creation. And the picture of the Bible is that, particularly, for instance, in Psalm 104, we don't have time to read it now, but one of the creation psalms, one of the psalms that also talks about the story of creation. Creation exists moment by moment only because of God's presence. Now, this is a very different idea. An idea that might, in fact, be very helpful in trying to confront some of the problems and some of the issues that we're dealing with.
Do you think God then is going to let this go down the drain you're talking about in the year 2040 or 20 or whatever it is? Or is he going to step in actually and compound man? Where is God going to come in? Is he going to let us destroy this work?
I think God is waiting for God's people. And I think that all creation is waiting for God's people. Paul said much the same thing in the 8th chapter of Romans. All creation is waiting for the children of God, essentially to get their act together. The picture, the biblical picture, is that God and humanity and the rest of creation, and we'll just close with this, exist in an interdependent kind of relationship. We've focused in most of our theology only on this side and neglected this relationship and neglected this relationship. When humanity is reconciled to God, humanity is reconciled to the rest of creation. The biblical picture of redemption and reconciliation does not stop with humanity. It includes all the creation. For God sent his Son into the world not to condemn the world. The word is cosmos, but that the world through Christ might be saved. The scope of redemption reaches to all the creation, and those people who are redeemed are to be the way in which all creation is brought back
into redemptive relationship to God, which is why even these silly things like separating compostables and combustibles has great theological significance.